We're going to pivot here. Usually on the show, we kind of tackle issues that really affect Chicagoans, people in our area, the ins and outs of family law, employment law, estate planning law, like we did. But we do delve into big national topics, too, or state and local topics as well, and just look at them from the legal lens and try and get a sense of it from a nonpartisan perspective. That's at least our aim, certainly, and we hope to reach that. And often when it comes to immigration, we bring on Professor Cindy Byes from Southern Illinois University, who I think does a really great job laying out facts and then kind of letting us navigate through those facts. Professor, welcome back to WGN.
Thank you. Good to be here with you again.
I've got a text from the 773. I'm going to read you first, Professor, to start off on a good note. It says, Cindy Byes is the best. She was my faculty mentor as a 1L. I think that means a first-year law student at SIU. A great woman and a terrific law professor. That's from Jim, Professor Byes.
Oh, thank you.
There you go. A lot of times when we bring professors on to chat through things, I do get some complaints from people that suggest that perhaps professors don't live in the real world. They are too stuck in the academic world. And maybe there's some criticisms there in some regards, but you haven't just been in the academic world your whole life. I just want to like set up this conversation with some of the bona fides that you've represented the U.S. in court and in front of big situations, right?
Yes, before I became a law professor, I practiced law in Washington, D.C. for about 10 years. Part of that time was spent at the U.S. Department of Commerce doing international trade work. And so when you think about all the tariffs that are in the news, I used to enforce the unfair trade laws on behalf of the U.S. government. And then I also worked in private practice assisting international businesses grow and facilitate their businesses as well. And so that was my work in D.C. And then I also do continue to represent asylum applicants on a pro bono basis. So just had a couple of interviews this past week, in fact.
I didn't know you could be my tariff expert, too, Professor Byes. You just opened up a whole nother. I have a financial show Monday through Thursdays. So apologies in advance for questions on that front, too. Okay.
Okay.
Yes, exactly. And by the way, that's not always my view of professors that some of the texters have, that they do often live in academia, but most of them, or a lot of them, I should say, have previous experience in the private sector. Okay, I'm just setting that up because I just know that this is a hot button issue, the case of Kilmar Abrego Garcia and the broader implications of the Trump immigration policies. I will do my best, I promise listeners, to try and approach this from a nonpartisan perspective. I know we will not all agree on everything that we talk about here, but we try and cool the temperature on the show and just kind of get the facts through this sort of thing. So, Professor Byes, maybe we can just kind of start from the beginning, just broad strokes, what we know about this individual and his interactions with U.S. immigration courts and the federal government. I know that's a tall task, but maybe you can kind of just give me some bullet points here.
Yeah, so my understanding from reading the court opinions and news articles is that he originally came to the United States without authorization, I think when he was in his teens, mm-hmm. And he entered without permission. He was arrested at one point and placed in immigration proceedings, but he claimed to be afraid to go back to El Salvador because of gang violence. And in fact, an immigration judge did grant him a form of relief called withholding of deportation, which means that he showed that it was more likely than not that his life would be in danger if he went back to El Salvador. And so the immigration judge said, you can't deport him back to El Salvador because he would be in danger. And he has a U.S. citizen wife and child, has been in the United States since that order for at least 6 years, and then was about a month ago picked up in an IKEA parking lot and placed in government custody and deported pretty quickly without going back to see a judge again.
And he was deported to El Salvador, which was the one place that the immigration judge in 2019 said he couldn't be deported to, right?
That is right. He was not supposed to be sent back to El Salvador because of the threats of the gangs against him. with withholding of deportation, it is actually possible to send someone to a third country that would be safe if we could find a third country that would take that person. So it doesn't necessarily guarantee that you're going to stay in the United States the rest of your life. But for most people, when they are granted withholding of deportation, they are allowed to remain in the United States.
I will note that that was in 2019, and the Trump administration did have a chance to appeal that ruling by that immigration judge, but didn't. That may be neither here nor there, but it's just a point I wanted to make and point out. Now, the Trump administration claims that he is a violent member of MS-13. Professor Bice, this is going to seem weird to say, but whether he is or he isn't, I don't know if it is relevant in the rest of the discussion we're about to have about what happened when he was sent away. Because the government, the Trump administration's lawyers, have admitted that he was sent as a mistake, as an administrative error, and was sent there without due process, to the point that I don't know. I mean, it matters, I think, to us as citizens, whether he's a gang member or terrorist connections, or et cetera, et cetera. But I don't know if it matters to the actual conversation of what the Trump administration did and what the justices in the Supreme Court and other judges are asking the Trump administration to do now. Do you kind of see what I'm asking?
Yes, I think I do. And it's about this issue of due process, that if the Trump administration believes that he's a gang member, the proper way to go about it would be to bring some kind of criminal charges against him, or say that he violated his immigration status in some way, and go back before an immigration judge and ask that judge to terminate the prior order withholding his removal, and show that he is in fact a danger, and therefore his legal status here in the United States should be terminated. But that didn't happen. He was not told, what was happening, and he was deported very quickly without getting to see a judge again or having an opportunity to prove that, he believes he's innocent of the charges against him.
Okay, so he's deported to El Salvador, where he was the one place where they said they shouldn't be deported to. So this case enters the federal district situation, the courts, and a district judge essentially says this was, and in fact, a lawyer for the Trump administration admitted the mistake and said, when pressed by the judge, that this was, and that the lawyer himself was having problems getting, confirmation from the Trump administration. And there was ramifications to that lawyer for that effect. But that's not what I'm tackling today. But walk us through how this kind of walked its way up to the Supreme Court in recent weeks.
Yeah. So Abrego Garcia's lawyer went into federal district court and said, hey, you should not be deporting my client. He has the right to remain. The Department of Justice lawyer came in and said, actually, this was a mistake. There was, when confronted with the order by the immigration judge saying that he shouldn't be deported to El Salvador, there was an admission by the Department of Justice that he had been mistakenly deported. So the district court judge at that point said, you should get him back. And this has happened before. Occasionally mistakes are made, and people are deported who shouldn't be because they have, legal rights to be here. Maybe they have, a case that's still pending. And in the past, there are instances where the government has taken action to return someone who was incorrectly deported when they weren't supposed to be. So, as you said, it went up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court modified what the district court judge said a little bit.
Yeah, let's break that down because this is important. These words matter. The district judge said you must facilitate and effectuate, meaning what do you think the district judge meant by that, and then walk us through what the Supreme Court ultimately ruled.
Well, the Supreme Court said that the government must facilitate his return. And, part of our government's argument was that because he's no longer in U.S. custody, he's an El Salvadorian citizen. He is in El Salvador under the control of the government of his nationality, that they cannot unilaterally just grab him and bring him back. And the Supreme Court said, okay, we do understand that, but you can facilitate his return. You can certainly go and ask the government of El Salvador to return him and, assist in that process. And so facilitate was really a word that the Supreme Court used. They said, we understand that we may not be able to order you to get this man back in the sense that he's physically in the custody of another government and you would, you know, I guess have to invade their country potentially. But you can take steps to get him back.
Right. The Supreme Court recognized the wide sweeping power that the executive branch has in foreign matters. Right. The Supreme Court's not going to say, by all means possible, you must send military aid into the country to get him back. But we want you to facilitate it. And now it's this debate, Professor, about, well, how much work does the Trump administration have to show to, placate the Supreme Court's use of the word facilitate, right?
Yeah, and initially there were some statements by some officials in the administration suggesting that they weren't going to do anything, which clearly wouldn't be in compliance with the Supreme Court's order. But then there have been some subsequent statements where I believe it was Kristi Noem who said that they would be willing to send a plane to pick him up if mm-hmm. the El Salvadorian government were willing to release him. So, you know, that was a method of facilitating his return. I think at this point, the courts and the Department of Justice are kind of going back and forth about how much and whether it's being done in good faith, this facilitation of his return.
Yes.
You know, we observed the meeting in the Oval Office recently between President Trump and the President of El Salvador, and the President of El Salvador didn't seem inclined to return Abrego Garcia. On the other hand, I didn't hear President Trump come out straight and say, please return him. And we are paying El Salvador. We've already paid them, according to news reports, over $6 million to house these folks who we have sent to El Salvador. And so presumably we could pay to have him returned or say we're not going to pay more if you don't return him. So there are some other things that the Trump administration could do.
Right.
And, you know, the question is what will be sufficient for the courts?
Right. Some people might argue, hey, he asked, maybe we didn't hear it in that meeting that was public, but one could argue the Trump administration said, hey, could is it even possible to have this guy come back? President El Salvador says no. And someone might say, well, that was facilitating. And that's an argument that can be made in court. Other people would say, no, you have the power of the United States is a powerful country that can at will. I mean, we've seen the president do this with tariffs, try and influence decision. Maybe that could be something that is done. Or like you're saying, even the Supreme Court suggested we are paying them money to house these prisoners. Perhaps you could threaten to withhold that money. So it's just a game of what means facilitate or not. And now overseeing that that word and whether they're doing it or not is the district court that originally decided this that is now asking for regular updates, right?
Yeah. So last week, the district court judge asked for daily updates from the Department of Justice. And as a fellow lawyer, I have to say, I'm glad I'm not the lawyer that has to go into court every day and talk to the judge about this.
Right.
And, you know, the judge has seemed frustrated, has stated that there is not enough information forthcoming from the government about what's being done. And so there is a possibility that there will be further orders from, you know, the district court against the government to take additional actions to facilitate Abrego Garcia's return. But it's still a fluid situation where we're learning more each day.
Right. And this got appealed. The Trump administration then appealed again to the appellate court. I think about this process that is happening. And an appellate court judge, a 3-0 in the Fourth Circuit, including the opinion by a judge appointed by Ronald Reagan, I don't want to say slapped down the Trump administration. He recognized the broad sweeping powers of the executive branch, this appellate judge did, but did kind of meet the moment by saying, we have kind of come to a crossroads here. I mean, this is a big moment in judicial versus executive history.
It is, and I think that was Judge Wilkerson who made those statements. And honestly, I would encourage everyone to read that opinion.
Yes.
Because he really talks about the importance of due process And that, yes, the government has lots of power over immigration and lots of power to decide who should be here and who shouldn't. But we also have due process as a foundation of our constitutional system, meaning that people should be given notice and an opportunity to be heard before they lose certain rights or status or that sort of thing. And that was not followed in this case. And the judges seem to be sounding a warning that, you know, if this is allowed to go on here, then it has implications in many other areas of law. And we do have a bit of a standoff going on between the federal courts and the executive office right now. And again, from the perspective of a lawyer who, you know, believes in the rule of law and our separation of powers and checks and balances and all that, I certainly hope that the executive branch will show an appropriate respect for the court. It doesn't mean that Mr. Abreu Garcia is going to come back and be free to do whatever he wants. What it means is that he should be given an opportunity to show that he's not dangerous.
Yeah. It's a hypothetical question, and I don't know if I'm just stretching this too far, because I'm trying to, like, if someone out there is like, what do we really, it's one person, I don't think he has a criminal past, but there's allegations that he was a gang member, maybe those are true, he shouldn't be here, he entered here illegally in the first place, right? He broke the law coming into the country, you know, what's the big deal? Am I stretching it by saying this, Professor Bies? The government's argument, Trump administration's argument is, we made a mistake, but there's nothing really we can do about it anymore. That's unfortunate, but it is the reality. I'm a U.S. citizen. If they send me to an El Salvador prison, what's to stop an administration from then saying, clearly we shouldn't have sent John to an El Salvador prison. It was a mistake. But he's there now and there's nothing we can do about it. Am I taking that analogy or that hypothetical too far, Professor?
I would like to say yes. I think there is one key difference, and that is that you are a U.S. citizen and that you would remain, I think, subject to the jurisdiction of the United States in a way that someone like Mr. Abreu Garcia may not, because he is of El Salvadorian nationality. However, once you are outside the United States and in the custody of a foreign government, then it's more diplomacy that gets Americans back, not military force. You know, you run into the same conundrum, right?
Yes.
How do we get you back?
Right.
We see these prisoner exchanges, you know, with Americans held by Russia, right? And we're certainly not invading Russia to get them back. We're negotiating and doing prisoner exchanges. And so if the United States were to deport a U.S. citizen, and deportation isn't even a word that is used with U.S. citizens. It's a
right.
immigration term, but, you know, to send a U.S. citizen mistakenly to another country, it would make it difficult to
bring you back,
return that person if the foreign government were not cooperating.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to happen. I just am wondering if the legal arguments that the Trump administration is using could be extrapolated. And perhaps maybe I've just gone too much into the hypothetical. Professor Bies, I got to take a break before the news. You don't mind hanging on a little longer, do you?
I will stay. That's fine.
All right. Sounds good. We get some more questions on the text line, too, I want to get to. And getting a lot of great texts, questions for the professor, and just comments on the situation involving Kilmar Abreu Garcia. This is Let's Get Legal. We're powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. We tackle issues that impact people, of course. So we talked about estate planning in the first hour, but we're diving into this controversial and hot-button topic of immigration law. For that, we go to Cindy Bies. She's a professor at Southern Illinois University who spent time in the private sector as well, still represents some clients seeking asylum, as she told us at the start of the hour, and also represented the U.S. in cases of international law in the past. Professor, this is a great question. We always get it, and I know this is confusing to people, and maybe it's because it's just not laid out so clear. Maybe it is. I don't know. But this person, referring to Abreu Garcia, entered the country illegally, which is true. He shouldn't get due process. Can you explain why he does get due process?
Yeah, for a couple of reasons. One, we often talk about our Constitution as being territorial, which means that when you are physically present in the United States, you do have certain constitutional rights, including due process. And part of that's because we don't know necessarily who is here legally or not, because there's so many different types of status. In this particular case, Mr. Abrego Garcia was essentially claiming asylum in the United States. He said, I am very afraid to go home because of the gang violence there. And he applied for withholding of deportation. And as I said, that means that he has to prove it's more likely than not that he would be persecuted or even killed if he were to be returned to El Salvador.
The burden's on him, not the U.S. government for deportation.
Correct.
Okay.
That is right. So, and he met that standard. He was able to show that his life was really seriously threatened in El Salvador.
But does that mean he was then here illegally after that moment, or here legally after that moment?
Yes. Once he has withholding of deportation, he is lawfully present and he has the ability to work. And then, as we all know from the news reports, you know, he also married a U.S. citizen and, you know, has a U.S. citizen child. Many times you can be sponsored by your U.S. citizen spouse as well, although it does take several years to go through that process.
Someone wanted to know, but what if he never actually tried to go through the process of becoming a U.S. citizen? They asked, had he ever applied to come to the USA before crossing the border? Has he ever made an attempt to pursue residency in the USA? I don't know if you know the specifics on that. I don't even know if they're publicized, but does that even matter, Professor, in this case particularly?
Yeah, so I don't know the answer to that, and I don't think it matters. He did follow the legal procedures that are available to him by claiming asylum and withholding of deportation, and our court system did grant him that relief.
Someone wanted to know, 847, what crime did this man commit in El Salvador to be imprisoned in El Salvador? If he hasn't committed any crimes there, he should be released from their prison. He should then be free for the U.S. to go and get him. I kind of get a little bit why this person is asking this, and just the legality in general of this sort of transactional go back to your country and you're immediately sent to prison. What do you, I don't know if you know the argument that the Trump administration is making for why they are sending people immediately to an El Salvador prison. Is that just an agreement between the two countries and they are wanted by the El Salvador government, so they have the right to do so, or that's under their own jurisdiction, they can do whatever they want with people?
It really is a matter of what the El Salvadorian government does. I understand that Bukele, the president of El Salvador, really ran on a hardline criminal stance that, you know, the country was experiencing a lot of violence, a lot of corruption, et cetera. And he was elected by the people of El Salvador to deal with that problem. And he takes a very hard line on that. You know, I would assume that the El Salvadorian government can make a determination whether to release the men that they have in custody that are sent to them by the United States. If they're El Salvadorian citizens, that's up to the El Salvadorian government what happens to them once they're back in El Salvador. That said, I will also point out that human rights organizations have said that El Salvador is violating the rights of many of the people who are in prison in El Salvador because they are not giving them due process either.
A lot of people then say, okay, well, what next then? All right, let's say you want to bring him back to the United States. What could the Trump administration do then within their means and the process as you understand it to ultimately end up at the same conclusion, whether maybe sending them ultimately to El Salvador or to another country or arresting them here in the United States? Or like, are those the things that the Trump administration could do to both satisfy the Supreme Court and to satisfy the due process that he is entitled to?
Yeah, if they brought him back, there are a couple of different avenues they could pursue. If they do have criminal charges to bring against him, then they could certainly charge him with a crime in the United States and go through the criminal procedures and the criminal courts. If they do not have evidence of a crime, but they believe that his immigration status should be reviewed because of subsequent developments since he was granted withholding of deportation, they could go back to the immigration courts, ask them to, you know, reopen the case against him and charge him with some kind of violation of immigration law, or, you know, that he's perhaps violated the terms of his withholding of deportation in some way. But then they would have to show evidence of that, you know, in an immigration court that his status should be revoked or changed in some way.
Yeah, I just feel like a lot of people who maybe feel, hey, this guy came in the country illegally, he should be in the El Salvador prison. You know, that's an opinion you have, and that's certainly a valid, maybe I shouldn't say valid, it's your opinion, right? You'd think that that's what's the big deal. I think there's an assumption that people on the left are like trying to make a hero out of this guy. And maybe some of them are, right? We've seen a politician go down there and visit him, and maybe you could make an argument that the leftist, some people on the left, I should say, are trying to glorify who maybe this person is, and they're this great human, and maybe they're not. I don't know. I'm just looking at it simply, Professor, from a process standpoint. I just don't like when any administration, Republican or Democrat, kind of goes off the rails a little bit and makes this a moment where we do have a potential. Am I crazy calling this a constitutional crisis or a potential one in the next couple of weeks and months?
If the executive branch openly defies a Supreme Court order, we do have a constitutional crisis because the court, of course, does not have its own army to enforce its rulings. We have a system where we respect their decisions, even if we disagree with them. And, you know, we try to change the law in other ways if we think the Supreme Court got it wrong. But we don't, historically, presidents have generally obeyed and respected the Supreme Court, even when they have disagreed with them.
Even when they trash it, even when they trash the decisions and say, I'm going to do things a different way. I mean, people will point to President Biden, who tweeted out after the Supreme Court ruled his student loan forgiveness plan wiped away. He said something like, I don't think he said, I don't care, but he said something along as I'm going to do it my way anyway, or I'm going to figure out a way around it. But he didn't just tell his education secretary to cancel the payments altogether. He presented a new plan or a new executive order that then was challenged in the courts. Like, these are different situations.
I would agree that lots of presidents criticize Supreme Court decisions for lots of reasons. But usually they do respect them enough to say, okay, you've told me I can't do it this way. I'll figure out something else that is lawful, that does comply with the law, but also achieves my policy goals. And I think there are ways for the current administration to do that as well. There are lots of people who are in the United States who do not currently have permission to be here. And I think I heard a figure today that the Trump administration has deported 100,000 people in its first, 100 days. And so, they are achieving their goals. The question is, are they doing it in a way that complies with constitutional norms and particularly in this case, due process? And I think when you start accusing people and imposing consequences without giving people notice and an opportunity to be heard, you make mistakes. And that's the problem, right? That people are wrongly accused and don't have an opportunity, whether they are citizens or non-citizens, whether they're lawfully present or not lawfully present. And that's why we have process to reduce mistakes and make sure that, in our criminal system, that we get the criminals and not the innocent folks that end up in jail.
Someone texted in the 708, there's been no discussions about the others sent to this El Salvador prison. Should they have been deported? Why are we only talking about one man? How about the others? I imagine we're talking about this one man because, one, he had legal representation and had that order in 2019 from an immigration lawyer saying, or judge, excuse me, that you cannot send him to El Salvador. I don't know if the others make that criteria, or maybe they don't have the representation to bring it up, or maybe that through all the processes they were sent there completely legally. I don't know if you want to wax poetic about that, Professor.
I don't know if I'll be poetic, but I can't address the question. And there are a number of people who have been deported to El Salvador who also claim that they were wrongfully deported, that they did not have their due process. Some of them have representation, and there are absolutely cases pending in the federal courts where courts have also ordered the government to stop those deportations, to provide more process to people. There was an order that was issued at 1 a.m. in the morning, just this morning, from the U.S. Supreme Court telling the Trump administration that they are not allowed to do any more deportations under the Alien Enemies Act. And that came from the Supreme Court in the middle of the night because they were so concerned that these deportations were continuing despite lower court orders telling the Trump administration to pause them until they could have these court hearings.
So wait, to not pause. Sorry to interrupt you. I apologize. The Supreme Court ruling wasn't that you couldn't deport anyone else, but that you couldn't use that act, the 1798 Aliens Enemy Act, any ones that you're deporting under that justification, you need to pause.
Yes. And the reason that's particularly important is because the Trump administration is using the Alien Enemy Act by saying that we don't have to give due process under the Alien Enemies Act, that it sort of supersedes the need for the usual rules because it's a situation of war and invasion and that sort of thing. And so that's particularly why the Alien Enemies Act has been relied on by the Trump administration as a way of getting around the requirement of providing due process.
Okay. I've got to take one last break here. We're getting a couple more questions on the text line. We'll wrap it up with Professor Bias, who's given us too much of her time here on a holiday weekend. A lot of great comments coming in on the text line, and I appreciate them, kind of from both sides of the equation here. People seeing this argument on both levels about what happens in this particular case of Abrego Garcia, or perhaps in some of the other immigration situations happening with the Trump administration. Professor Bias, someone just wanted to know, plain and simple, what's next with this case, the specific one about Abrego Garcia? If the Department of Justice's updates don't meet the level that this district judge has said and the Supreme Court has backed up and an appellate court too, is the Trump administration doing enough to facilitate the return of Abrego Garcia? Like, what happens next if the updates don't meet their satisfaction, the courts?
Well, I think there are a couple of things that might happen. As we discussed earlier, there's been a affirmation from the federal appellate court that the district court is correct, that the government has not yet done enough. I understand that the Trump administration is once again going back to the Supreme Court to have them take a look at that issue. So I suspect that the Supreme Court may have to weigh in again on the issue.
Like, to be more specific about what they mean?
Yeah, exactly. To be more specific, like, what would satisfy their order to facilitate Abrego Garcia's return? So that's one thing that could happen. If the federal government doesn't meet the expectations of the courts for what is appropriate in the situation, in their view, then, you know, it is possible that the courts could start holding government officials in contempt. And in the other cases that we were discussing, the ones involving the other deportations of people to El Salvador, the district court judge did have a hearing this past week and did find, in fact, that the conditions for holding people in contempt have been met. They've given the government one more chance to sort of correct the problem. And then they have said they will likely start issuing contempt orders against government officials.
What does that mean? What happens then?
Well, criminal contempt, which is one of the things they're talking about, would mean that officials from the Trump administration, not President Trump himself, most likely, but other officials, would be placed in jail. That is criminal contempt until the government complies with the court's order.
I have a weird question. Who physically arrests someone for contempt, criminal contempt? Is it local police jurisdiction, or do you need federal officers to do that?
Well, this is a federal court. And so likely the marshals in the federal court would be the ones that would execute that.
And they are under the, who's their boss? Is it?
That's a good question.
Is it the attorney
general?
That's
a very good question. You know, a lot of times most of the time when the government or when a court issues a contempt order, it's against a private attorney. Although it's not unheard of that you could have a government attorney in contempt of court. But again, most of the time, the government tries to obey court orders, so it doesn't arise that often. And so, again, we talked earlier about a constitutional crisis. And, you know, if the court does order that there is criminal contempt that's appropriate here, it's not entirely clear how that will be executed and implemented.
Right, because John Roberts runs the judiciary from an administrative standpoint. But he doesn't have an army of federal officers at his disposal, as far as I understand, unless it's these federal marshals that's what that means. But they report to the attorney general, who could, in theory, be the one being held in criminal contempt.
Yes, that is possible. Again, I am not familiar enough with the chain of command for the marshals that work with the courts to know exactly how that would play out.
Well, let's hope we don't get there.
My expertise.
Let's hope we don't get there, right? Maybe the Supreme Court.
Right, exactly.
Maybe the Supreme Court. Maybe the Supreme Court clarifies and says, "Nope, the president has asked. That is enough of a facilitation. He has met his burden, and then this case is over, and the Trump administration effectively wins." Maybe they say, "Here's five steps you could take instead," suggesting some ideas, and the president says, "Well, they've asked this. They've been more specific. Let's execute these five steps and see what happens, and we've met that burden." I think that either one of those decisions, whichever side of the aisle you're on, I would rather see a resolution that does not pit the executive against the judicial in a way that people are getting arrested, or maybe there are orders not to arrest people. You see what I'm saying? Like, that would be a better resolution than anything else, I feel like. One of those two things.
Yes, we certainly would like to avoid that constitutional crisis if there's some way to negotiate this situation that perhaps respects the right of due process, but also facilitates, you know, respect for the courts, and also allows the president the appropriate amount of deference for policy that they have enacted.
Exactly. Still respects the executive branch, which is important, but also kind of gets this stymied issue back to, well, I don't even know how to say it, Professor. I just hope cooler heads prevail. That's all I'm going with. Professor Bies, thank you for breaking this all down. I appreciate your time on a busy and a holiday weekend. Enjoy. We'll talk soon, I promise, okay?
All right. Thank you. And happy Passover. Happy Easter to those who celebrate. I hope you all enjoy your holiday weekend as well.
Thank you very much. That's Professor Cindy Bies from Southern Illinois University. Great discussion.